Hello from the podcast that prides itself on its huge geographical range, spanning an entire continent. Today we're coming to you from two rooms in the same city. We're both in London, but Dominic says he doesn't like it when we record in the same place because I look at him too much.
It's true, and also, as I've said before, London is so huge. It would like take me an hour and a half to get to you, and frankly, you're not worth it.
Okay. Glad to hear it.
No, but we are actually meeting in real life tomorrow, which I'm really looking forward to, and that wasn't meant to sound as sarcastic as it did.
No offense taken. I'm looking forward to seeing you too, just staring at you for the entire time.
It's fine if you look at me, just not when I'm recording, please.
Okay, point taken. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine, although I was rather disturbed to see in my local supermarket that they're now serving something that's 50-50, half meat and half fake meat.
Whoa.
And I think it's the beginning of the apocalypse. I don't understand the point.
Did you buy any?
No, I just buy fake meat.
I'm intrigued to find out what it tastes like, though.
Yeah, and I can imagine some people will be intrigued and will buy it once, but like, who's going to carry on buying that? Because if you've got the sense of like, oh, I should be eating less meat, then probably you'll just go for the vegetarian option, don't you think?
But maybe it's got rid of that like nasty texture that quite a lot of fake meat has. My brother, he started doing kind of YouTube reviews of fake meat options from supermarkets, but he hasn't put them online yet because he's too embarrassed. But I think he should. He's got a natural knack for reviewing vegetarian burgers.
Oh my God, that's amazing. Will you tell him about this 50-50 fake meat thing? I mean, of course he'll know about it anyway because he'll be listening to this podcast diligently, I'm sure.
And also because he's a fake meat expert, yeah. But I'll get him to put it next on the list.
Anyway, enough about fake meat. What are we talking about this week?
Well, to make up for the lack of our geographical range in terms of where we're recording this week, I'm taking you very far away for the interview. Do you remember when I went to Kenya for work in December?
Yes, it was decades ago, or a decade ago.
It was last decade. And in between all the work I did, in inverted commas, mostly dancing and going out and having fun, but don't tell my former boss that. I was lucky enough to interview one of Kenya's most brilliant public intellectuals, the cartoonist and commentator, Patrick Cathara. This year marks the 60th anniversary of quite a lot of Europe's former colonies in Africa becoming independent. 1960 is sometimes called the Year of Africa. 17 countries won independence from France, Belgium, and the United Kingdom. So it seems like quite a good time to talk about what the relationship between our two continents looks like today, and whether decolonization is something that is finished. Spoiler alert, Patrick thinks it isn't. So that is coming up. But first, as always,
good week, bad week. And before you play the jingle, thank you everyone, by the way, for responding to our listener survey. You can still actually fill it in if you haven't already. The link is in the show notes, but I just want to say sorry to the one listener who said that they were slightly scared of the good week, bad week theme tune.
Did someone say that?
Yeah, they said it always gives them a bit of a shock.
Oh, no.
And that they really don't like it. And I think that's fine. I mean, it's not the best review I've ever had. But I'll take it.
It's our jingle man, Jim, who's going to have to deal with the consequences of that one.
And my pride.
Who's had a good week, Dominic?
Okay, I'm kind of bracing myself for this one. It's one of those like really detailed EU stories that are really complicated and and easily we could get wrong.
Great.
It's amazing when I try and like dive into understanding something new, it feels quite intimidating to then have to like explain it to everyone. So,
but that's what we're here for, like trying to understand all the stuff that seems really intimidating, so you don't have to. So go on then. What are you explaining for us this week?
Okay, well, we're talking about accession. Is accession like a normal word that people know, even?
It sounds like the latest Netflix series that everyone's watching.
That's so true. Actually, it sounds like the HBO series Succession, but much less fun. Yeah, accession is the process of like joining the EU. And this week, it's been a good week for the accession prospects of Albania and North Macedonia after Emmanuel Macron said that he was ready to look again at progressing with these two candidate Balkan countries who have been hoping to begin the official stage of negotiations to join the EU. We're not talking yet about actually accepting them as members, but we're talking about moving on to the next stage of the conversation. So they're already candidate countries, but they would be joining two other countries, Serbia and Montenegro, who are currently in this official negotiations phase.
So there's like kind of a series of waiting rooms, and they're now in like the next closest one. Or about to be.
Well, yeah, they're not there yet, but Macron has said that he's willing, he's open to the idea that they might move into that next waiting room.
That's very nice of him.
It all seems really vague when you don't actually know what the conversations look like. But essentially, it is good news for Albania and North Macedonia, who you might remember they were pretty miffed when Macron controversially blocked their accession progress during a meeting of the European Council back in October last year. Everyone seemed to blame Macron personally for the blocking of the accession progress for these two countries. But in the case of Albania, it was actually also the Danes and the Dutch who objected. So let's not forget that. One of the reasons why France wanted to pause the progress of EU enlargement was because they weren't that happy with like the procedures around how EU enlargement goes. And the French European Affairs Minister at the time referred to it as an endless soap opera of talks.
World's funnest soap opera.
Indeed. But it's also perhaps understandable that there'll be some scepticism around allowing some of these new countries into the EU, especially considering they're countries with rather tumultuous recent history. Albania, for example, has had a pretty big problem with organized crime and corruption. But they have already enacted reforms and policies to try and improve this situation. Many EU officials are quite grateful for this and believe that the EU should now live up to their commitments. One official said, quote, North Macedonia and Albania have done their homework and implemented painful reforms. We now need to live up to our commitments to them.
I mean, that was why part of why everyone was so pissed off at Macron is because North Macedonia like literally changed the name of the country partly to try and improve their bid to get into the EU, right?
Exactly, they did. And there's also a fear that if the EU stall for too long on these issues around the Balkan states, that the Balkan states will think, well, screw you, we're going to move closer to some more autocratic states like Russia or China or Turkey. And that would not be great geopolitically for the EU. Anyway, the Commission accepted to make some reforms around the accession procedure. This included things like giving the EU states power to delay or even reverse the accession process if necessary. And this compromise has resulted in Macron hinting this week that France's position could shift depending on the results of the upcoming report from the Commission about Albania and North Macedonia's cases. It will be released at a meeting of EU ministers in Brussels at the end of the month, so we'll be waiting on tenterhooks. Albania's Prime Minister, Edi Rama, isn't getting too excited yet, though. He compared Albania to a jilted lover, saying to journalists, please don't talk about March. We are like lovers that wait to get married. And imagine preparing for marriage. Everything is ready, and then the other side doesn't show up.
I like that he managed to take something as adminy as European membership talks and like managed to turn them into something really romantic and poetic. Also, quite good expectation management. Like, if you think a date is going to go really badly, it might end up going a bit better.
It's really sweet. Although he got a little less sweet and got a bit catty when defending Albania's democratic stature. He was comparing Albania's political processes favourably to some bigger countries such as the UK and US, who he pointed out have their own quote-unquote disruptions in their political process.
I mean, fair enough.
Meanwhile, in North Macedonia, the other country that's being assessed here, the parliament this weekend agreed to dissolve and call early elections for April the 12th. And a positive assessment from the EU Commission in March could possibly help the pro-EU Social Democrats and hurt the nationalist anti-EU party. Whether or not that comes to pass, we will see. But for now, many in North Macedonia and Albania will be pleased that France are going to take their accession plans seriously after a pretty shaky few months.
And I bet you're also really pleased, Dominic, that you don't have to research this topic anymore. Well done. You got through it.
Who's had a bad week?
It's been a bad week for pigs, cows, and basically all of the animals that we eat. And that is because, despite all the talk about Europe being at the forefront of efforts to fight climate change, it has emerged that the European Union has spent 60 million euros over the past 3 years on campaigns to get us to eat more meat. Now, that is despite the overwhelming evidence that our lust for eating animals is a huge contributor to climate change. For a couple of reasons, cows fart a lot, producing loads of methane. We keep cutting down trees so that we can use the land to put more livestock on. It's not new, this idea that eating less meat would really help the fight against climate change. And full disclosure, I say that as a non-vegetarian, I'm eating a bit less meat than I used to, but I did have chicken nuggets over the weekend and they were delicious.
Oh my God, maybe you're the person that needs the 50-50 meat, fake meat.
It's kind of for me. I'm going to give it a go and report back. So the general wisdom from scientists is meat, not so good. And the European Union is like shouting through a megaphone at the moment about like how the environment is its top priority. While at the same time, apparently, spending tens of millions of euros trying to get us to eat more meat. This 60 million euros figure has come from a Dutch animal rights group, Vacadier, who've been looking at the way that EU money gets used to prop up the meat industry. Just to give one example, there was this campaign called Pork Lovers Europe, which got 1.4 million euros worth of funding for marketing, including painting a bus to look like a giant pig. And if you go on the European Commission website for this campaign, it talks about declining pork consumption as something that's like really worrying and the need to reassure Europeans that there's no link between pork and cancer, despite research suggesting that maybe there is. Another campaign, just to give you another example, got a 2.5 million euro subsidy to encourage people in Denmark and Sweden specifically to eat pork. And if you go on the European Commission website, again, it talks about the fall in consumption like it's really bad. Just to give you a little quote, pork is no longer a natural part of the diet of young Scandinavians. They tend to eat less meat in general and to avoid pork in particular. The aim is to increase consumer demand.
Oof.
I mean, look, it's no secret that farming lobbies are really powerful within Europe. And I get that the fact that we're eating less meat is going to be really hard for people that produce it. But I also don't feel great about my French taxes being used to encourage people to eat more sausages.
No, it doesn't sit that well either with the idea that the EU is like going to be the place of the Green New Deal.
Yeah, I just feel like they need to sort their messaging out.
How have they responded to this criticism?
They issued an extremely boring statement, which I can read if you want, but it doesn't really say anything.
Are they constantly evaluating?
They are constantly evaluating, and they will launch a public consultation on how this kind of thing works, which is nice, I guess.
But they're not denying it.
No, I mean, it's all like literally there on the Commission website. It's very, very mixed messaging. Save the planet, eat the pigs. Ah!
Before we move on to the interview, just a quick shout out to Maria Timakova, who's our latest Patreon supporter. You too can join this merry band of supporters on patreon.com/Europeans podcast. You get access to our Facebook supporters group. If you donate a certain amount, then you might even get a postcard from me and Katie and a personalised audio message.
We're actually recording a bunch of those tomorrow when we see each other, which will be nice. If you would like to chip in to help this show running, you can do so at patreon.com/Europeans podcast.
And just a reminder that we still have this competition running currently with Live Europe. For listeners that are in Copenhagen, London and Brussels, we're giving away pairs of tickets to Charlotte Dos Santos gigs. We played a clip of her track in last week's episode, and you can find out details about the competition on our Facebook page. All you have to do is post on Facebook, Instagram or Twitter something in which you tag us saying that you listen to us and that you would like to get free tickets to her gig. We will be doing a draw on the 24th of February. So you've got a few more days to post if you're interested.
Someone suggested that because Charlotte is a producer of wonderful jazz, people should post their competition entries under the hashtag Europeans Get Jazzy, which I'm not against.
No, for people who have posted it without that, we are still accepting your submissions. But yeah, from now on, why not put a hashtag European, what was it?
Europeans Get Jazzy. If I say the word Eurafrica, do you know what I'm talking about?
Is it something like what Johnny Pitts talked about, Afropean?
No, not really. It is a intriguing part of European history that I'm ashamed to say I didn't really know anything about until recently. Basically, in the years just after World War II, when European integration was like just becoming a thing, those European powers that were involved in those discussions were still colonial powers, right? So Europe in the 50s controlled vast stretches of Africa in particular. And at the time, there was this idea knocking around that if Europe was going to integrate, we should also integrate our colonial possessions and kind of manage them jointly. Obviously, the idea wasn't maybe we should stop exploiting these countries in Africa, but it was more like, let's make the exploitation of Africa part of the European project. Now, this was never like a super, super mainstream idea, but it did still inform the talks around the European project in its very early days. And I was amazed to find out, actually, that if you go back and read the text of Europe's founding treaty, Treaty of Rome, most of the land that is covered by that treaty is not in mainland Europe. It's our colonies. Like, it refers to these huge parts of West Africa that were under French control at the time, and the Belgian Congo, and even this little bit of Somaliland that was under Italian control. I found this whole thing really fascinating and a really good jumping off point for the conversation I had in December in Nairobi with Patrick Cathara about Europe's relationship with Africa, past and present. You wrote recently about this concept, Eurafrica,
mm-hmm.
and I'm someone who is interested in European history. I never heard of this expression. Right. Why do you think so many Europeans don't know about this part of our history?
Well, it's not just Europeans, to be quite honest. I only came across it when I was doing research for that particular article. And the fact is, lots of the colonial history is buried both for the colonizers and the colonized. There has been, I think, on both ends, an attempt to reshape history to try and pick out particular themes that legitimize the systems that exist. In the case of Europe, this idea that was pushed for a very long time that colonialism was essentially a benevolent thing. You know, it brought something called development, it brought modern medicine, you know, gave us roads and cars, etc. On the other side, you've got the people who got independence, who are trying to legitimize themselves. And to be quite honest, lots of them went out in the period after independence, behaved very much like the colonials they'd kicked out. And they don't want that continuity to be seen so that people can actually start questioning whether or not they are legitimate. So they also have an inbuilt incentive, in essence, to try and massage history, to tell the story in a particular way. So that's how we end up, all of us, not really knowing what happened.
We were talking before I hit record about how colonialism is taught in British schools. Mm-hmm. And I was saying that we didn't really learn anything about... Well, I remember in class seeing like this map and a quarter of it was pink.
Right.
This kind of thing, but not really much else. How does this stuff get taught in Kenya?
Well, it's not taught at all. The colonial past in most of our history books wouldn't take more than 2 or 3 pages. So in essence, it would be, we were not colonized. And then somebody drew some lines and suddenly we were colonized. And then we fought for independence. So we know nothing about that. We know nothing about how societies were reordered, how they were changed. But when you actually start looking at that period, is when you actually realize that's how the society got built. You know, the things that we assume are natural. We have 42 tribes, or Africans are made up of these units called tribes. When you actually go back, you discover these were created. These were actually a function of colonialism and of their administration. Basically, what happened was when the British, for example, in the case of Kenya, came in, and then they went about actually ordering the society to fit in to what their ideas were. So, for example, in Kenya, they came and they drew administrative borders. Everybody in District A would be a Kikuyu. Everybody in that district would be a Luo, etc. And over time, those identities hardened. And a generation later, people wouldn't remember what was there before. You know, when you move around, lots of Africa, you find people called traditional chiefs, as if every African villager had a chief or whatever. Again, not true. You know, this is just a result of the whole colonial experience. And this inability or this reluctance to learn the history means we can't interrogate why it is that we've got these divisions And then they become so ingrained in our politics, they become the source of most of our conflicts are ethnic based because of this idea that they're ancient. But they're really not, you know. So for me, it's really been a struggle to try and find out what happened and how it relates to how we do things today.
When we talk about decolonization in Europe, we often talk about it like it's something that happened in the 60s and was like a kind of discrete historical event. You really see this as something that is far from over. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about why you think that?
First, you've got to understand what colonization was or how it was experienced. Basically, you had societies that had particular structures and particular ways of being imposed upon them and ways of thinking. It was very much based on race. The whites on top, Indians, the Asians in the middle, and the blacks at the bottom. And the blacks were really deprived even of their own history. So that was never taught to them. So they were told essentially they are rootless people without any achievements, cultural or otherwise. And one of the purposes of decolonization was to actually undo the damage that that did about how people saw themselves, you know. And unfortunately, when we got independence was a political event. That was what was the discrete event. Power was handed over. But the ways of thinking did not go away. The colonial state was retained, in essence, in most places, the same way it was inherited. And that just kept reinforcing, again, the way people thought of themselves. So you hear talk of there's never been homosexuality in Africa, you know. Or you'll hear somebody say, well, Africans are not suited to democracy, you know. They really require strong leaders, you know, authoritarians to tell them what to do. All this is something that people were taught during colonialism, that you can't do stuff for yourself, you can't think for yourself, you know.
And the homosexuality thing is really interesting because we interviewed another writer on this podcast a while back who was arguing, you know, a lot of Anglophone Africa has these very strict sort of anti-sodomy laws that date back to the colonial period, right?
If you read the text of the laws, they're pretty much the same, essentially just exported to all their colonial places. And then people grew up thinking that this is the way it's always been. The truth is, a vast majority of the population, if we are to have a poll today, would say, well, there's never been homosexuality in Africa. It's a Western import. But then why did you need laws against it if it was never there? You know, and if you look at the history, it was widely practiced in communities, even in Kenya. But people simply have imbued what used to be a Western religious ethic of Bible says this is bad, so it's bad. And people have come now to internalize that and to think that that is their culture, that is where they came from. And the work of decolonization is to actually undo those things, is to start thinking about why is it that we believe this? Is it actually true? And it is a task that we barely started. We've barely started looking at the archives across the colonized world. Most of those archives are not in the former colonies. They are actually in Europe. But what are those documents doing there? They should be back here where we can start reconstructing what happened. And it's not just here. Algeria have a case against France to get their archives back.
The past can't be undone, obviously.
No, it can't.
But what can we do today to build a healthier relationship between our two continents?
So it's got to be based on a clear understanding and appreciation of what actually happened. In the case of Europe specifically, is an appreciation of the advantages that colonialism gave them. There was an acknowledgement in the aftermath of the Second World War that for Europe to recover, it required the resources that were in their colonies. Mm-hmm. And this was openly discussed.
And I think even in the Treaty of Rome, which founded what we know today as the European Union.
Right.
I mean, I think if you look at the landmass that is covered by that agreement, Most of it is not in Europe.
Most of it is actually outside. Most of it is in Africa. And there was an open recognition. That's what they needed. But you see, the way the story is told these days is that the traffic was the other way. It was them developing the colonies, not them exploiting the colonies.
And actually, if you read the wording, it does sound very much like that. It's like, oh, we must right. help to develop these territories. It's worded. You read it, you're like, what a nice thing to do.
Right, exactly. That's the impression it's intended to convey, because what it's doing is covering up the actual robbery that's going on. And I think that for the relationship to improve, there's got to be acknowledgement that this exploitation, this harm was done. And the things that continue, for example, in the way the world trading system is structured, to take one example, the people who grow coffee, I think it's something like a $70, $74 billion industry. We get less than a sixth of that. And it's replicated across all these primary products that are produced in Africa. If you look at cocoa, it's pretty much the same thing. You know, chocolate, everybody thinks comes from Switzerland or Belgium.
You're saying it doesn't?
You know, if we start looking at those, we can start asking, okay, how do we reform this system? So it's a much more fair system. It is less extractive. One other thing that is disturbing for me and that comes out of this refusal to see that past is that those tropes then continue in relationships with other nations and other societies. So right now we've got China coming into Africa in a big way, again with the whole talk of we're coming to help develop etc. But what they're doing is extracting. So the resources that are on the continent are seen as fair game for everybody else. They are not resources for the people who live here. And I think that idea is born of that colonial experience that nobody wants to address.
What do you say to people who argue they might acknowledge that European powers did terrible things, but they say you cannot blame the events and actions of 60, 80, 100 years ago for problems that Africa has today? What would you say to that?
I'd say there's an element of truth to what they say. My argument is not at all to say that Africans are blameless in this. I think the African leadership is primarily to blame for the state that Africa is in. But we've got then to understand why it is that leadership behaves the way it does. It is a product of a colonial system. Basically, what we did is we switched white colonials for black ones. But because they looked like us, we thought they were one of us. You know, the plunder has continued. Look at what happens in places like Congo, in Kenya, etc. The money is essentially hoovered up by our elite and taken to places like Europe. So they're essentially copying the very same model that the colonials had. It's not about saying we are blaming the West or whatever, but it's actually addressing the systemic problem and saying the problem is this continuing colonial system. And until we get rid of that, all we'll keep doing is play musical chairs with leadership, but then nothing fundamentally ever changes because we are not having the conversation that we need to have and we're not solving the problem that we need to solve.
Do you think that conversation is being had? If you and I have this conversation another 10 years, do you think you'll be like, great, everything's great in Africa has been decolonized?
Well, first thing I think, the if we disaggregate this idea of Africa, which for me, firstly, is itself quite problematic, you know, one continent, everybody thinks everybody's the same on it. Within Kenya, you're starting to see a questioning. If you were to go back about 2 decades ago or so, it would have been sort of sacrilegious to question Jomo Kenyatta's role as the founder of the nation, as freedom fighter, etc. Now everybody is doing it, you know. And that gives me hope. The more people get courage to question these narratives and to understand that the official history they are taught is deficient, then they will start subverting some of these narratives.
I'm really looking forward to having this discussion with you in another 10 years' time.
Well, pretty seeing how sooner. Things
have Thank you so much, Patrick. It's been
You're very welcome.
Really, great
really enjoyed
to you.
It.
I find it really interesting to think about the fact that thinkers in Africa are trying to disaggregate Africa and to see it as different countries with loads of different separate identities, whilst we in here in Europe, or some people, are trying to think about Europe more as a whole and to find a European-wide identity. maybe that's just another reminder of like the privilege we have as Europeans.
Maybe, but there is also this bit kind of like Pan-African solidarity movement as well. I guess maybe it's about the way some Africans feel like they've been seen historically as sort of like all basically the same. That must get super annoying.
Yeah, I totally get that. And I guess both things are possible at once. But very interesting interview, Katie. Thank you for going all the way and interrupting your dancing with doing an interview for us.
You're welcome. I had a lot of fun talking to Patrick. He's a really, really lovely person, and it was an absolute pleasure to talk to him. Should we have a happy ending?
Yes. Now, remember those happy times when we used to make mixtapes for people that were actually cassette tapes? I mean, nowadays, if anyone makes a mixtape, it's usually like a Spotify playlist or something. Probably lots of our listeners are too young to have even ever held a cassette tape in their hands. But Stella Vedel from Berlin was 12 years old when 25 years ago she took a cassette mixtape on her Spanish holiday. It featured some of her favourite songs of the moment, Shaggy, the Pet Shop Boys, Bob Marley. Somewhere on the holiday, she lost the tape. It probably wasn't the end of the world, but it also wasn't something that she thought she would ever find again. Stella went on with her life without her tape, but 25 years later, she stepped into an art exhibition by British artist and photographer Mandy Barker, and she saw a cassette tape with a track listing in the exhibition that was remarkably familiar. She took a photo so that she could check the listing when she got home.
How was she able to check it if she lost it?
She had a CD version of the mixtape too, because actually it was originally a CD mixtape and she would transfer it to cassette tapes for when she went on holiday because they were easier to travel with.
This is all so retro.
It's really retro, isn't it? Somehow she had kept that CD version of the mixtape and she was amazed to discover that she was right. It had exactly the same track listing, minus the first two tracks, because she remembers she'd gone off those two tracks before she went on the holiday. So how the heck did the artist known as Mandy Barker come into contact with Stella's tape and end up using it in her show? Well, Mandy makes a lot of work that's made up of plastic debris that she finds on the beach. I know we're not meant to mention plastic for a while or plastic on beaches after our How the Hell Do You Make an EU Law episode, but I thought the story was too good. Forgive me, Katie. Mandy had found the tape at the Playa de Barlovento beach in Lanzarote. She had even got it restored and made playable for the exhibition. What are the odds that Stella would find herself in this exhibition 25 years after losing the tape and see her own tape? I find it totally extraordinary.
That's wild.
It really is. And yet there is a rather gloomy moral to this story. It's about marine litter and the fact that the tape managed to survive 25 years. Eek. Happy ending!
Yet again, Dominic Kramer strikes with the happy ending that isn't really a happy ending. Thank you very much.
Apologies. I've had a trying week.
We'll be back with more after another trying week. Is that a good way of ending the show? Next week. In the meantime, you can find us on all of the usual social medias.
Twitter, at EuropeansPod. Instagram, EuropeansPodcast. Facebook, EuropeansPodcast. Or you can email us, hello@EuropeansPodcast.com.
Cast.com. Well done.
I'll learn one day.
Clearly has been a trying week. Go and lie down, Dominic.
Thank you.
We'll see you next week, everyone.
Adios.
Bye.